This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. All the leaves are brown. Did you survive the earthquake over the weekend, America's $53.2 million movie quake? California's disaster had Dwayne Johnson, advanced special effects, and people with great hair and dirty faces running around screaming. ...1974's earthquake movie called, oddly, Earthquake, had Charlton Heston, really bad special effects, and people with afros and shag haircuts running around screaming.
Millions of people, living, loving, planning, fighting.
Do we need more movie disasters, replays of old franchises, Fast and Furious, Godzilla meets the Avengers with hobbits?
Big man in a suit of armor. Take that away, what are you?
I'm a hobbit from the Shire.
As American culture ground to a screeching halt as we contemplate yet another helping of Bush-Clinton loaf for our political main course coming up in 2016.
By the grace of God.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
I want to be absolutely clear with our people.
With all due respect.
I've been so blessed to be part of a family that has committed its life to public service.
Oh, it's such an honor. I think it's also a challenge.
Emphasize this enough. You need to get out. And I mean now.
Okay, baby, that's a little too extreme there, but if you are on the ledge a little about recycled culture and the death of originality, stay tuned for a monumental debate on the subject, and we'll hear from you on when it's okay to recycle songs, takeaway tips, or competent covers.
This is Ryan from Minneapolis, Minnesota. The best cover of a song ever would be the Cinnamon Girl cover by Typo Negative. It's a really good example of just the key tonality completely changing how a song sounds, the whole vibe of the song.
But we begin here on The Takeaway, only on The Takeaway, with the drama in the Senate that has ended with no ending but has paused the collection of some big data by the NSA as a deadline for reauthorization of parts of the Patriot Act expire in a weekend session of the U.S. Senate. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. So, hey, Todd, was it Cliffhanger on the Hill 9, the Battle of the Metadata Warriors, or something more original?
Did I hear Paul Giamatti in your intro there from San Andreas?
Yes, you did.
All right, so let's take Paul Giamatti's John Adams from HBO and helicopter him right into the middle of the plot of 24. He's one of the framers of the Fourth Amendment. So we'll put him in 24, the counterterrorism show, and that's about where we are maybe with the expiration of the Patriot Act. Freedoms and liberties meet security, John. Parts of the Patriot Act have expired as of last night. It was clear when Republicans came out of a conference meeting with the clock ticking down to the expiration of provisions of the Patriot Act that it became obvious that there was going to be an expiration. Listen to the Deputy Majority Leader, John Cornyn.
Well, we need to, unfortunately, at midnight, because of objections, this important program was going to go dark. And it's up to us to do everything we can to restore some ability to protect the American people through the use of actionable intelligence.
I guess Cornyn is saying there's room for a sequel on this debate.
And there's going to be one because Congress is not going to allow Section 215, which is the business records, also known as the bulk collection provision of the Patriot Act, to permanently expire. They're going to make some changes to it. And the USA Freedom Act, which has passed the House overwhelmingly and was pre-negotiated by a White House who had to change this law because of Edward Snowden, they know that that bill is now probably going to pass in the Senate with some minor changes. But because of Senate rules and because of one senator who's running for president, that's Rand Paul, it couldn't happen tonight, and it probably can't happen till very late Wednesday night or Tuesday morning now. And that's because Rand Paul is using this moment. He's railed against the Patriot Act for his entire political career. Listen to him on the Senate floor last night.
We are not collecting the information of spies. We are not collecting the information of terrorists. We are collecting all American citizens' records all of the time. This is what we fought the revolution over. Are we going to so blithely give up our freedom?
Is Senator Rand Paul the real winner here, if you can call it that?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. He has railed against the Patriot Act for his whole career. There were 40 or 50 supporters with I Stand With Rand t-shirts sitting in the Senate gallery for this rare Sunday session as Rand Paul took to the floor and as Rand Paul had confrontations with other senators as he tried to speak. John McCain was one of them. They got into a spat on the Senate floor. McCain is a proponent of extending Section 215, extending bulk collection, giving the NSA every authority against terrorism. I caught up with McCain off the Senate floor after he got into what amounted to a rare Senate confrontation. Listen to McCain.
Well, I think he obviously has a higher priority for his fundraising and political ambitions than for the security of the nation.
Ooh, it sounds like Senator John McCain is giving us a preview of what the GOP primary race is going to sound like a little bit.
John, he wasn't alone. There was a conference meeting last night of Republican senators. They railed against Paul for his position for allowing parts of the Patriot Act to expire because of what he can do under Senate rules. Rand Paul wasn't even in that meeting. He skipped it, and that made Republican senators even more mad. Look, these provisions of the Patriot Act will be reauthorized. As I said, it'll probably go till Tuesday, so you got, about a 72 or maybe 96-hour window where certain provisions have gone dark here, but they're coming back.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We'll always take a sequel from you, Todd.
Thanks, John.
But even if the end point of this debate on the Hill is an end to Patriot Act sections 214 and 215, there are some who think this whole ritual is more like a stealth re-endorsement of the Patriot Act in principle, if not technically in the law. With us now is Julian Sanchez, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. What does this look like, ritual or a real debate here, Julian?
Well, what we saw last night was mostly ritual. I think it was a bit of show for the upcoming presidential primaries. The real headline, I think, ought to have been something to the effect of overwhelming majority agrees to move forward with surveillance reform after a brief and fundamentally irrelevant expiration of 2% of the Patriot Act.
What is surveillance reform as you see it?
Well, the thing that got 70-plus votes on Sunday was the USA Freedom Act. It's obvious that Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, is going to try and add some amendments to dilute that and water it down further. It's not, I think, the legislation in its current form that any civil libertarian would have written from scratch themselves, but it's not bad for what it covers. There's a lot it doesn't cover. It doesn't touch the NSA's massive collection of international communications, including American communications, under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. It doesn't touch the incredible quantity of bulk surveillance that happens overseas under Executive Order 12333, but it does cover a range of overlapping authorities, Patriot Act authorities, some of which don't expire at all. Section 214 doesn't expire, and national security letters don't expire. 215 does, and it amends all of them to require the government to use specific selectors in asking for records. So instead of doing what they did previously with phone metadata and what they had been doing with internet data and saying, we want everything, it'll all be relevant because we'll have a big database and won't that be helpful, they'll actually have to use narrower selectors or identifiers to say, all right, these are the select, this is the phone number we're interested in, this is the email address we're interested in, and we have a showing that that is relevant, not that everything is relevant.
All right. So, Julian Sanchez, is it your position and the position of the Cato Institute, so to speak? I know you don't speak for all of them there. That the majority in America, or at least on Capitol Hill, actually supports significant reform of surveillance and elimination of some of these techniques that were exposed by Edward Snowden, and that it is the leadership that is stymieing that majority?
I think that's absolutely right. I think we saw that this this reform bill had an overwhelming majority in the House, had a strong majority in the Senate. When it failed to move forward before the recent recess, it still had, I think, 57 votes. So it was had majority support before. It just didn't make it quite to 60. And yeah, what we have, I think, at this point are a series of dead enders, effectively, who are really being a bit more Catholic than the Pope. You've got the intelligence community itself, maybe not cheering for this reform, but acknowledging that they can. That they can work with it, that bulk collection maybe hasn't been all that useful after all, and that they are going to be able to do their job with a model of collection where they're able to get things quickly, but they're able to get things specific quickly, not huge databases. The intelligence community is on board. The administration's on board. Polls suggest the American people are largely on board. And you really have, I think, a small number of leadership who had, I think, backed themselves into a corner by, right when those first Snowden revelations come out, being so full-throated and uncompromising in their defense of whatever the intelligence community said was a good idea, that they now find it embarrassing to back down and admit that that was, frankly, quite a bit of spin.
So, Julian Sanchez, what's your view as a civil libertarian? Is Edward Snowden a Patrick Henry, a Paul Revere, or is he more like, you know, one of the Rosenbergs in the view of civil libertarians? And again, the Rosenbergs actually were wrongly convicted by most accounts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I usually like to say I don't think it matters that much. He's released a bunch of documents that are obviously significant that have transformed, really, the American surveillance debate. And it's important to look closely at what he's disclosed and decide whether that's the kind of society we want to live in. I'm glad, as someone who works on these issues and cares about knowing these things, that he did it. If you want to criticize his choice to release maybe more information than you think was absolutely necessary to inform the public, that's a fair criticism. At the end of the day, it's not whether you think Edward Snowden is a good guy or want to have a beer with him. It's about whether we live in a country with surveillance policy that is consistent with a free society.
Julian Sanchez, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much, Julian.
Thank you.
Later this hour, is originality dead in America? We're asking you the best or worst remakes or covers you think are out there.
I gotta say, the worst movie remake ever is Footloose. Hands down. Dumbest remake.
Hi, I'm Pam from Sonoma. And Sabrina, with Harrison Ford replacing Humphrey Bogart, is the worst remake. And I have just one question. Why?
I have no answer, Pam. From Charlotte, North Carolina, Planet of the Apes. Why remake an amazing classic? I think I was 15 when I saw Charlton Heston come around the bend on that beach and realize what had happened. The remake wasn't even close. Give us your remake retake take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
As the world watches, or doesn't, another migrant refugee crisis demands global attention. Delegates from 17 countries gathered in Bangkok on the weekend to address the ongoing crisis of the thousands of Muslim Rohingya fleeing persecution in Myanmar.
The spirit of cooperation is prevailing in this room. Finger pointing will not serve any purpose. It will take us nowhere.
That's the head of the Myanmar delegation, Tin Lin, speaking at the meeting on Friday to avoid responsibility for a growing humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, the Dalai Lama has urged Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's pro-democracy icon and a fellow Nobel Peace Prize laureate, to stand up for the repressed people of her country. She has thus far remained silent, even though she is in parliament and a member of the opposition. Joining me now with more from Bangkok is Jonathan Head, BBC Southeast Asia correspondent. Welcome, Jonathan. And how has this meeting sort of played out?
I think as well as can be expected, but given the differences of views which you heard there from the Burmese, the Myanmar delegation, clearly they weren't going to work out who was responsible. The most important thing they achieved, I think, was that they clarified that those who may still be stranded at sea, and we just don't know how many boats are out there, need immediate help, that all concerns about blame or worries about migration had to be put aside. And there is now something of a concerted effort. I say something, it's not yet that well coordinated, to go out and search for boats that may be stranded in the Andaman Sea. Remember, many of those boats packed with migrants may have been at sea for many weeks, would have normally in the past have landed secretly in Thailand and have been smuggled into Malaysia, but they can't do that as the Thais are cracking down, and that's why there's so much concern for them. So that, you know, there was a real commitment to do that. It isn't quite working out. I mean, the Burmese authorities detained a boat off their own shores, which presumably was heading in the direction of Thailand, on Friday, more than 700 people on board. Yet they're holding that boat offshore, and they're not saying who's on board or even what's going to happen to them. So, you know, there's still some disagreement about exactly how these migrants should be handled.
Is there an option that doesn't include Thailand and being smuggled to Malaysia?
Well, unfortunately, you know, the fact is that the Rohingya people are treated extremely badly in Myanmar. That is treated as second-class citizens. They are barred from moving. I mean, it's appalling treatment. I've been there. I know. I can see it. It's akin to apartheid in South Africa. It's that bad. There are complicated reasons why the Myanmar authorities are reluctant to address it. There's a lot of demonization and hatred of Rohingyas very widely felt in Myanmar. But the fact is that is what's causing them to leave. But because the business of trafficking people has become so immensely profitable in recent years, particularly in Thailand, where officials and members of the security force have got involved ransoming these people, holding them until their families pay big ransoms, it's sucked in others. So we've actually got a lot of people being pulled in from Bangladesh too. Something like over 80,000, we think, over the last year have left across the Andaman Sea heading for Thailand, which is the most porous way, and aiming to get jobs in Malaysia. And that is clearly something the Thais themselves have to look at as well.
Any sense of the accumulated Rohingya casualties from this perilous journey?
We just don't know. It's extremely heartless. Nobody wants these people. They're regarded by the brokers and traffickers who move them as little more than an economic commodity. If they can't pay, they've been left in these ghastly jungle camps almost to starve to death. And we know numbers of them have died. Mass graves have been found in recent weeks. I don't think we'll ever know. And sadly, this has been the lot of the Rohingya people for a very long time. The mistreatment they've suffered inside Myanmar at the hands of the Burmese authorities goes back decades.
What would explain the silence of Aung San Suu Kyi, who's in the opposition, who certainly has standing to speak on this, even though probably no real clout to actually do something? The silence still is a little mystifying.
Yeah, she's the only person in Myanmar who has that immense moral stature where people genuinely would listen to her. But you've got to remember two things. One is that she is now a politician. She has clear stated ambitions to be president of Myanmar, even though there are very big obstacles in her way. And the Rohingyas are so despised in Myanmar, championing them would be very damaging for her political ambitions. That's the cynical view. The other is that it is such an emotive issue in Myanmar, and there's complicated history behind it, that it's hard for anybody, ambitious or not, to stand up and say, look, we need to treat these people decently. For decades, the military demonized them and told everyone else in Myanmar they're illegal immigrants who don't belong. There's genuine historic sectarian tension between them and the Buddhist population of Rakhine State, where they come from. It would be very difficult for anyone. I think there's a lot of disappointment that Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been so courageous in the past, doesn't want to speak about this, but she's made it very clear. And I spoke to her about it, I remember now, nearly 3 years ago, and asked her, and she simply said it's a complicated issue and it would be wrong for me to abuse my moral stature, is the way she put it, to step in there and try and fix it. She's right. It is very difficult to solve. It can't be solved quickly. But given the fact there are a million Rohingyas who've got nowhere else to go, it's a massive stain on the record of a Burmese government that has actually made quite a lot of progress, that's been applauded as rejoining the world community. And a start has to be made somewhere. It will still, I think, require sustained international pressure on the Myanmar government to rethink and at least consider making a place for the Rohingya people, some opportunity for them to build decent lives, which would give them an alternative to jumping in these dangerous boats and getting sucked into the awful trafficking business in Thailand.
So in conclusion, then, you say millions in this Rohingya diaspora, there are estimated 100,000 living in camps. For those people and for the people around the world, this conference offers no real message of change.
No, it doesn't. And realistically, with that many countries, all of whom have got, frankly, black marks against them for the way they've handled it, it wasn't likely. It's very much the Asian way to avoid open dispute. I think there is an understanding now here in Thailand and in the region that this is not just a dirty private little matter that they can sort of shove aside. The whole world is watching it now. Their community of nations, there is an association of Southeast Asian nations here, has been very damaged by it. So I think they understand, you know, that something ought to be done. Whether they actually get as far as making a decent place for the Rohingya people in their own homeland, which really is inside Myanmar in the end, that's going to be a long-term problem.
Jonathan Head, BBC Southeast Asia correspondent, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI. I need you to believe in my
words. I feel like a broken record. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And in Broken Record America, we have decided to declare war on opportunistic remakes, mediocre sequels, tepid franchises. Ever seen that caption at the beginning of films? Based on an original story, a true story, something fresh that really happened. Maybe there should be a new disclaimer. Based on nothing original whatsoever. Have we lost all original thought in America, Jeff Yang?
The capacity for it or the execution of it. I think there's actually plenty of originality in Hollywood. I just think it's coming from places people aren't expecting anymore.
No more originality in America, Gary?
I think it's a question of tendency. And I think Americans will always be original. America is a home of originality. But the tendency of large business organizations is to gravitate to the predictable, which leads you to sequels and to derivatives and franchises.
So you have to dig?
Yeah, well, it's around. There's original things.
Somewhere.
Here we are, you know.
Hello, original stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, where are you?
It's under that rock over there.
I mean, we're here being original. Right?
Exactly, yeah. More from Gary and Jeff in just a minute. Meanwhile, whose license to do a sequel or a cover would you revoke or suspend? Wilmington, Delaware. I love The Cure and I love Jimi Hendrix, but The Cure's cover of Purple Haze is terrible.
This is Kevin from Dallas, Texas. It's Lauryn Hill and the Fugees' cover of Killing Me Softly that makes me run kicking and screaming from the room. One of the most awful cover songs I've ever heard.
Okay, that's it for The Cure and The Fugees, whose remake license just gets a warning.
Bill from Rehoboth, Massachusetts, and I am a huge fan of Guns N' Roses' cover of Live and Let Die. Originally by The Beatles. I like the original, and I know they used it for a Bond movie, but there's just something about the Guns N' Roses cover that's just so much better.
First of all, Live and Let Die was a McCartney tune, not Beatles, for one of the most dreadful incarnations of the License to Kill Bond movie franchises. Let's just say Guns N' Roses could not fail here. Retreads aren't dead, you say?
Hi, this is John from Philadelphia.
I don't think you can have a conversation about best cover songs without mentioning Johnny Cash's cover of Hurt. Trent Reznor is quoted as saying, "Wow, I feel like I just lost my girlfriend because that song isn't mine anymore."
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
But one more license suspension before we go. Northampton, Massachusetts, worst. Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights. I played a drinking game with friends where every time they did something awful, we had to drink.
You mean dance with you? Feels like dancing with my mother's ironing board.
I blacked out. Not recommended. Give us your remake, retake, take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
The time of my life. No, I never felt this way before.
Can you go back, Jack? Do it again. We'll turn it.
And now to our Monday big idea. Has pop culture become binge culture? Simply hitting the same button in the rat cage to give us a repeat zap from disasters, superheroes, disasters, monsters, Mad Max, superheroes. Are we so disconnected from politics that we have no energy left to look beyond the old familiar faces as the 2016 campaign approaches? Here to debate whether we're up the creek of culture without a paddle of originality, oh, what a dreadful metaphor, is Gary Silverman, who writes for the Financial Times, and Jeff Yang, who writes the Dow Jones column for the Wall Street Journal. Jeff and Gary, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, we got a little tease from you. Gary, you're kind of a... yes, on this question of loss of originality. But Mr. Yang, you seem to be a decided no. There's plenty of originality out there. I'll let you begin, Jeff Yang.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing here in both politics and popular culture is a reaction from the mainstream to the margins kind of crowding in. We're starting to see more and more diverse voices. And by diverse, I mean diverse in many contexts, not just culturally or ethnically. And as a result, the middle is being pressured and as a result is kind of gravitating towards things it's familiar with. You see the election of Barack Obama, for instance, and the sort of almost violent shivers and shaking that occurs across the firmament of, you know, sort of straight white America. And I think you see a sort of similar thing here in Hollywood where the familiar becomes something that is almost a reaction to, I don't want to call it contempt, but to difference in all its forms.
Another earthquake movie? Gary,
I think
I don't see any originality.
No, and I didn't see it this weekend either. But I think what we're talking about mainly is an investment story and mobilizing money behind projects. And money now tends to be very large money, big money. And what big money loves is an annuity. It loves predictable income streams. I mean, one of the great heroes in American life is Warren Buffett, because he's a great discerner of the income stream and he can see predictable cash flows. And what you see is it's much easier to say we'll do Fast and Furious 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 than to take a flyer on something. Similarly, it's easier to do another Bush or another Clinton, not so much necessarily for the public, and I think it's a good point, because actually the public rebelled in 08 against the Clinton inauguration and went for Obama, who was a completely unpredictable, unexpected event in American history. But the donor community goes right back to doing Hillary and goes right back to Bush.
So it's the big money that's really driving this in politics.
I think it's just the nature of big money. And actually, to some extent, big money isn't as thoughtful as it might seem, because it's committee money. It's institutional money. People go into meetings and decide what's the right and safe thing to do. And what you get then, and actually you're seeing it in different ways in the culture, not everywhere, not absolutely and forever necessarily, but you see it where all of a sudden we are watching Fast and Furious 7, I guess 8 is coming, and there may be Fast and Furious movies for the rest of our lives.
That's good. So Jeff Yang, you have some experience with this.
I'm a little compromised in that regard, yes. Standard disclosure, my son Hudson Yang is in fact the lead on Fresh Off the Boat, the 11-year-old lead of Fresh Off the Boat.
Is that a push against the center by a bit of diversity, or are you basically seeing a 1950s sitcom with all Asian faces?
I think there's something fundamentally different from just sort of looking at things like Fresh Off the Boat as taking Fonzie and just giving him a deep tan or something. There's definitely an upsurge in, I'd say, risk-taking, at least within the realm of casting and development. And we've seen that this last pilot season, which was, by many accounts, the most risky we've seen so far as alternative casting and development of stories that sit outside of that comfortable white suburban family or white urban professional space. At the same time, I do absolutely agree. Hollywood is kind of a swarming medium, right? And it is actuarial in its drive. It's looking for the best place to put its money for the least amount of risk and the greatest amount of return, like every business. What we're seeing, though, now is that there are, I think, new stories that are, in fact, reframing that economic dialogue. I mean, no one expected it, perhaps, except for those of us who've been watching for, you know, two decades of demographic change. But Empire was the single biggest show on TV. And I don't think you could actually look at Empire and say, wow, that is exactly what we saw, you know, 30 years ago, just with a different set of characters.
I would say it's amazing, actually, how little originality there is, considering what an original country it is. I mean, the country is, you know, in the Bob Dylan words, you know, busy being born and not dying. I'm not arguing that people aren't original and creative and dynamic, but you just see it everywhere and always. And similarly, that the United States remains a changing place and that it's drawing so many people from around the world. And that experience is always new. You know, a new group of people comes here. And immediately, and that's actually most of American comedy is new groups of people coming here and being amused by the weirdness of their lives, which we can probably all speak to.
Part of this is what was often talked about in the crisis of the news in the 90s and the early part of this century, in the sense that it was difficult to do nuanced stories, and that everything kind of devolved to celebrity and, you know, sort of sex and very, very mainstream kinds of stories in the news. And we're seeing that in popular culture, partly because people are more siloed. They watch their own stuff. There isn't necessarily a common ground unless you're talking about the Kardashians, earthquakes, and, you know, the Clintons and Bushes. So the center, what everyone connects with, is getting narrower and narrower.
Well, that's a factor, and I think, and to some extent, you see that a lot in the music world now. People tend to grow up and listen to a certain niche genre of music, whereas American musical culture, you know, those of us who grew up watching the Ed Sullivan Show could see, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and the Beatles and Leonard Bernstein or whatever. You know, you'd see a lot of, hear a lot of things. A lot of that is becoming codified. And actually, to some extent, music is really quite, to me, the crowning moment was last year's Billboard Music Awards, when they brought out a hologram of Michael Jackson, because it was like, to me, that was the symbol of the music. You know, if they could, they would have Michael there. And they have some Michael replica, or a Madonna replica, yeah. You know?
I mean, but in a way, what we're talking about right here is interesting, because the notion that Hollywood or big music or other kinds of kind of mainstream culture are becoming less original is actually a reaction to the diminishing relevance of the mainstream. We're saying, actually, that the world is getting more original, that there are other places people are consuming, perhaps more niche, more fragmented, but certainly more personally relevant kinds of content. So it's not so much that Hollywood is becoming less original and therefore popular culture is becoming less original. It's that popular culture is becoming more diverse, again, in its breadth. I think that it's really interesting to see this process, but it's not some sort of death of the big idea. It's more like the proliferation of many smaller ideas.
Jeff Yang writes the Dow Jones column for the Wall Street Journal, and Gary Silverman is the U.S. National Editor at the Financial Times. And here's something somber for you to think about today. A son talks about his father.
I'm Beau Biden, and Joe Biden is my dad. In 1972, my father went to Washington to look at his new office space. My mom took us to go buy a Christmas tree. On the way home, we were in an automobile accident. My mom, Nelia, and my sister, Naomi, were killed. He decided not to take the oath of office. He said then, Delaware can get another senator, but my boys can't get another father.
Beau Biden died of brain cancer over the weekend with his loyal father, the vice president, by his side, who would take the train home from Washington, D.C. every night so he could kiss his boys goodnight. Those boys kept him going.
But you know what most people don't understand, didn't go through what we went through? You need them more than they need you. You need them more than they need you.
The vice president said in a statement, Beau embodied my father, saying, a parent knows success when his child turns out better than his dad. Think about the Bidens today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.